Well, thank you, Brother Mac. You see from the Bible class schedule that the plan is to consider the prophecy of Zephaniah in four sessions. So three chapters, so that shouldn't be too difficult. God willing, this will happen at the rate of roughly one session per month. As we were reading the last part of this chapter one, you probably noticed the repeated times that the word day was mentioned. And this, in a nutshell, is Zephaniah. It's prophesying about certain days of Yahweh. Certain days, a series of judgments that would come upon Judah and upon Gentiles as well, as we will see in the various chapters. But it's also not only judgments, but it's a message of hope. And we're going to consider Zephaniah under basically four headings: judgments upon Judah, judgment upon Gentiles, why judgment was necessary. And then in all of that, there will be a positive message of hope, which we'll try to bring out. And we've been taking Zephaniah in our Sunday school class for, I don't remember how long. And so those folks who are part of that class may have to endure this evening, but it might be just a good review, because we started, I think, Zephaniah in September, and so this is what we did in September. So, who was Zephaniah? We'll try to understand who this prophet was, first of all, and you do have a handout showing a bit of a genealogy. Who were his parents? Where did he fit? Where did he fit in the Jewish hierarchy of his day? Well, on the chart, it's also on the overhead here, you see at the very top of that chart, we have good King Hezekiah, who is also called Hiskiah in Zephaniah. And he had two sons, Manasseh and Amariah. And they, in turn, had their own sons. But Manasseh became the king. Not in focus?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Ken. That better? Well, that's good. Actually, you do have it on your sheet, Ken, if you can't see it up there. It could be that my printer isn't doing as good a job as it used to. Yeah. Anyway, Manasseh became the king, and his brother Amariah was just part of the royal family. But he was also the great-grandfather of Zephaniah, making the prophet Zephaniah part of royalty. He was in the royal line. So if you keep your eyes on that chart or on your page that you have in your hand, we'll just read Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 1 again, and see if you can follow it on the chart. And the word of the Lord which came unto Zephaniah, that's the blue word there, the son of Cushai, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hezekiah. So that's where we find Hezekiah in the word Hezekiah, in the days of Josiah, the red word. He was a king, and he was the son of Ammon, king of Judah. So Zephaniah prophesied in the days of Josiah, a good king Josiah. He reigned for some 31 years, and then he died at the hands of the king of Egypt just 2 or 3 years before Judah was invaded by Babylon. And so we're going to look at the relationship between good king Josiah and Zephaniah. As you can see, they were cousins. some sort of cousins. Maybe somebody in the audience could tell me, what sort of a cousin was Zephaniah to Josiah? Was he third cousin, sixth cousin, 26th cousin? I don't know. Do you know, Jeff? Might be removed as well. Okay. But he was some sort of a relative of Josiah in the form of a cousin, a second, third, whatever it was. And it's not unlike the bird family tree. So I can see we have Jeff on this screen. There he is. There's Jeff. And once upon a time, there was a brother or a man called Bird, and he had two sons in England, and they were called Arthur and Ernest. And many of you would know Arthur and Ernest Bird from the years gone by. Tommy's shaking his head there. And Arthur had Christine. Everybody knows Christine, my wife's mother. And then there was Arthur Hibbs, her brother. And then there's Jeff. And then Ernest's line, there was Marjorie. Marjorie is still in Victoria. And Joni Bennett. And then there's Matthew Bennett. So you can see the Bird family tree and the family tree of Hezekiah is very similar. Matthew Bennett is in the same position as Zephaniah. In that similar situation, and Arthur Hibbs represents King Josiah, which is quite appropriate. And there's a supportive family relationship between these two people, and of course between Matthew and Arthur. And that was good because they had a big job to do in the ecclesia in Jerusalem at that time. They had an uphill battle to fight, and they needed each other's support. The ecclesia here is affected by the world around us, and to combat that, we have scheduled activities in the ecclesia which are designed to help us focus on the hope of Israel. Well, these two cousins, Zephaniah and Josiah, were a team trying to get the ecclesia of their day focused on the hope of Israel. Back to the Bible, back to the beliefs of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Moses. And why was it such an uphill battle? Well, it was an uphill battle because of this chap, Manasseh. He had been very busy for about 50 years promoting the mysteries of Babylon in its various variations, or the many variations of the mysteries of Babylon. And the population in Judah was saturated with these false doctrines that had come out of Babylon. Manasseh had been reigning for some 55 years, and for 50 of those years he had actually polluted the ecclesia. And King Josiah and Zephaniah and Jeremiah were all trying to change that. But you can imagine if there'd been 50 years of false doctrine being preached in the Victoria ecclesia, how big a problem that would have been. People would say, well, maybe we'll believe what you say, but what about this? And it would be an uphill battle. 50 years of false teaching. Now, the population in Judah at that time was very much afraid of Josiah because he was very aggressive as a king that was determined to wipe out false doctrine and get back to the Bible. And the people were afraid of him, but secretly, even though they outwardly obeyed Josiah, they were afraid of him only on the outside. And they secretly worshipped other gods. They worshipped other gods because they really believed what Manasseh had promoted. Even though he had repented at the end of his life, he couldn't undo what he'd done. Even the grandparents of Zephaniah, had been tainted by this false doctrine. There's Gedaliah, the grandparent of Zephaniah. What did he do? We know he did one thing. He called his boy Cushai. Cushai. And that was in memory of Cush. And who was Cush? Well, Cush was the father of Nimrod, who created the apostate religion that had become known as the Mysteries of Babylon, which Manasseh had been promoting. So Zephaniah's grandfather probably had been influenced greatly by Manasseh. And Judah was guilty of taking on a lot of these false doctrines that Manasseh had promoted. For example, they were secretly worshiping the Queen of Heaven. They were worshiping Tammuz. They were worshiping the host of heaven, which is a reference to star worship. And how do we know that? Well, Jeremiah was there, wasn't he? Jeremiah was like an on-the-scene reporter. He was giving an up-to-the-minute situation, what was happening in Jerusalem today, in his day. And he would have been trying to promote what Moses was promoting back way back there in Deuteronomy. Let's have a look at Deuteronomy for a minute. Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 19. And this is God speaking through Moses. And God says, Deuteronomy 4:19, lest thou lift up thine eyes unto heaven, and when thou seest the sun and the moon and the stars, even all the hosts of heaven, shouldest be driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord thy God has divided unto all nations under the whole heaven, then watch out. Watch out. Don't do that. Don't worship the stars, because the Lord, in verse 24, is a consuming fire, even a jealous God, and he will react. He will react, and he will scatter you among the nations. He will punish you. That was a warning in Deuteronomy. And Jeremiah, if you go to Jeremiah and see what was really happening in Judah in the time of Zephaniah, Jeremiah chapter 7, what were they doing? Jeremiah 7, verses 17 and 18. Here's God speaking to Jeremiah. And he says to Jeremiah, seest thou not what they do in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem? The children gather wood, the fathers kindle the fire, and the women knead their dough to make cakes to the Queen of Heaven, and to pour out drink offerings unto other gods, that they may provoke me to anger. That's what they were doing. Jeremiah chapter 19, verse 13. And the houses of Jerusalem and the houses of the kings of Judah shall be defiled as the place of Tophet, because of all the houses upon whose roofs they have burned incense unto all the host of heaven. They burned incense unto the stars, unto the host of heaven. That's Jeremiah 19:13. And have poured out drink offerings unto other gods. And what was the name of one of those gods? Well, go to Ezekiel chapter 8. Ezekiel chapter 8. And verse 14. Ezekiel 8:14. Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house. So this is in vision. Ezekiel, of course, had been taken into captivity, into Babylon. And in vision, he'd been brought back to Jerusalem to see what was going on. And there it was in verse 14. He brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was towards the north, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Tammuz was a Babylonian god. So that's where it came from. It came from Babylon. And Nimrod was the founder of all of this false doctrine. Nimrod is mentioned in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 9. And you probably remember that Nimrod built the city of Nineveh. Nimrod built the city of Babylon. And according to Josephus, Nimrod built the Tower of Babel. And this all happened around the year 2300 B.C., 2300 before Christ. And that was about 100 years after the flood. Nimrod built the Tower of Babel. Now, why did he build the Tower of Babel? Well, he built it so that he could get closer. He could get closer to the sun and the moon and the stars. It was a place of worship for those heavenly bodies. And they called that worship astral worship. Worship of the heavenly bodies. And he also set up a priesthood in direct opposition to the worship of Yahweh. Now remember Shem? It was Shem, Ham, and Japheth. They left the ark with Noah. And Shem was the forefather of the Jews, the forefather of Abraham. He was the forefather of the Semitic races. And as the son of Noah, he became the high priest of authorized worship. And from Genesis 11, verse 14, we can see how Shem was opposed by Nimrod. Shem was opposed. Nimrod opposed Shem and the God of the universe. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 11 and verse 4 and see what was going on back there. Genesis 11 and verse 4. This is the Tower of Babel. And they said, go to, let us build us a tower, a city and a tower whose top may reach on to heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. So the tower did two things. It got them closer to heaven, and star worship, that made a lot of sense. And it focused on making a new name for themselves. Look at that in verse 4. Let us make us a name, lest we be scattered. Now, it's interesting to note that the word in the English is name, but the word in the Hebrew is Shem. So what they're saying here is, let us make us a Shem. They already had a Shem. Shem was the son of Noah, and he was alive. In fact, he was alive during the whole lifetime of Abraham. And during the lifetime of Abraham, plus, he went for another 35 years longer than Abraham. So Shem was around, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he was likely the Melchizedek of Genesis chapter 14. Now, so what Nimrod was doing at the Tower of Babel was creating another Shem, another name, a competing form of worship. And the name was Nimrod, because he wanted to be the top dog. He wanted to be the high priest. So he set up a high priesthood in opposition to the official God-blessed high priesthood. So what Abraham left behind in Babylon was the outcome of all of Nimrod's efforts. Nimrod had a wife. Nimrod's wife's name was Semiramis, and she had a son called Tammuz. We just read about Tammuz, didn't we, in Zechariah chapter 8. And by the time Abraham left Ur of the Chaldees, these three were all dead, but the Babylonian population now worshipped them. They worshipped Nimrod, Semiramis, his wife, and Tammuz, the sun, as gods in heaven. They'd all gone to heaven, of course. And Nimrod was the head god, and his wife Semiramis, well, she was the queen of heaven. And Tammuz was Semiramis's son in heaven. So what Abraham left behind in Babylon was still plaguing Judah some 1,400 years later in the days of Zephaniah, and is the very reason why Zephaniah was written. Let's have a look at this astral worship for a minute. I say a minute because it's funny how time runs away, isn't it? Astral worship, the Babylonian mysteries. Nimrod was a high priest in direct opposition to Shem about 2300 B.C. Nimrod died. Now, Nimrod died because his wife, Semiramis, was a women's liber, and she wanted to be the chief. And his wife, according to the Babylonian folklore, arranged for him to be gored by a boar. Now remember, Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord, a mighty hunter in a literal sense, and he was also a mighty hunter against the Lord. That word can be translated both ways, before the Lord and against the Lord, and he was a good hunter. And he went hunting, and his wife somehow arranged for him to be killed by a boar. The tusks on a pig, a wild pig, killed him. So the story goes. And Semiramis then took over as Nimrod's, as the chief high priest, the high priest instead of Nimrod. And then, lo and behold, miraculously from heaven, Nimrod impregnated Semiramis from heaven after his death. And the result was Tammuz, of course. And at her death, at Semiramis's death, she became the queen of heaven. And Tammuz, the son of Semiramis, was at his birth the resurrected Nimrod. That's very strange, isn't it? First of all, impregnated from heaven, and then when he was born, when Tammuz was born, the resurrected Nimrod was who was born. So all these three gods were worshipped as gods when Abraham left Ur of the Chaldees around the year 2050. So with that background, let's have a look at Zephaniah's family, or at least let's look at Zephaniah, period, and look at the problem that he was facing. And you know, to a small remnant of the population in Judah, Zephaniah's words would have been very encouraging, because a small remnant would not have believed the mysteries of Babylon. But the majority of the population couldn't have really had much faith in what Zephaniah had to say. Let's read verses 2 to 6 again. I will utterly consume all things from off the land, saith the Lord. I will consume man and beast. I will consume the fowls of the heaven, the fishes of the sea, and the stumbling blocks with the wicked. And I will cut off man from off the land, saith the Lord. I will also stretch out mine hand upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place, and the name of the Chemarims, or Chemarims with the priests, and them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops, and them that worship and that swear by the Lord and that swear by Malcolm, and them that are turned back from the Lord, and those who have not sought the Lord nor inquired of him. So these judgments that God is now promising through Zephaniah would be four invasions by the nation of Babylon from the year 606 to the year 586 BC. Now that's 20 years, four invasions over 20 years. And Zephaniah was writing his prophecy some 10 to 20 years before these invasions began. So the nation was given time, you see, just like the people in Noah's day were given 120 years. The nation of Judah was given 10 to 20 years to repent if they'd have listened to Zephaniah, but of course they chose not to. In verse 3, we'll notice the word stumbling blocks, stumbling blocks. In the margin of my Bible, stumbling blocks, it's not something you trip over, but it was an idol. So he is referring to idols. And God says, I'm going to consume the stumbling blocks with the wicked. So that was a big problem plaguing the ecclesia. And we have to ask ourselves, is it a problem in this ecclesia? We have to find a lesson in these books that we look at. And if we do have stumbling blocks in our own lives, they can be like idols. And we have to decide how are we going to correct the problem if we have such stumbling blocks. Now, in verse 4, we find God stretching out his hand upon Judah. Now, when God stretches out his hand, he can do it in two ways. He can have his angels, his guardian angels, stretching out his hand and protecting us. Or it could be that it's a hand of discipline. Well, this is what it was in this case. Judah was about to receive God's stretched out hand of discipline. And they were going to be in trouble by the Babylonians. When the Tower of Babel was under construction, and just before they were scattered, Nimrod did establish this idolatrous form of worship that we've described. And the different nations that were developed, because the languages were confused, the people couldn't understand each other, so they scattered from one another, and that doctrine of Nimrod was taken with them. So the various countries that evolved as a result of God confusing the languages of the people, they took the idolatry with them, and because there were different languages, of course, they had different names for the same gods that they were worshiping back in Babylon. But it all started with Nimrod. Zephaniah chapter 1, verses 4 and 5, we have examples of these gods. Now, first of all, in verse 4, we have Baal mentioned. Baal is in there, in verse 4. Now, Baal was the god that Jezebel worshipped. Remember the Canaanite god of fertility? The Canaanite god of fertility, complete with its immoral practices. Why would you think that Baal would be called the god of fertility? Well, it does seem rather obvious that if the Babylonian doctrines have been sort of transposed into other countries, that Baal was the Canaanite name for the Babylonian god called Nimrod. As you remember, he was very fertile. He was able to impregnate Semiramis from heaven. And Tammuz, who was also considered to be the miraculously resurrected Nimrod, was proof of that he was a very fertile god. And therefore, the greatest god of fertility. So Baal and Nimrod probably were the same god with different names. Now, Chemarim. Chemarim is mentioned there in verse 4 with the priests. Now, the Hebrew word for Chemarim is Kamar, and it means black. And it refers to the idolatrous priests of Baal in Judah, and they all were dressed in black. The priests were dressed in black. And in Babylon, the priests of Nimrod were dressed in black, which is in direct contrast to the robes of the priests of the Aaronic priesthood, which were basically white with blue, scarlet, and purple added. But white was the dominant color of the official priesthood of God. Verse 5 tells us that Judah was worshiping the host of heaven, but also worshiping Malcolm and also worshiping Yahweh. And as we've just read in verse 4, they were worshiping Baal. And they were doing this all at the same time. Now, why do you think they were doing it at the same time? Because they were mixed up. They'd been indoctrinated by Manasseh so badly that they were completely confused. And that was the problem that Zephaniah and Josiah had to deal with, trying to get rid of all this confusion. So they were worshiping all these gods at the same time just to make sure they didn't make any particular god angry with them by missing one of them out. And it reminds us of the time when the Apostle Paul went to Athens, doesn't it? He went to Athens and he found a god that the people of Athens were worshiping. He says, "Ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things ye are too superstitious. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God." They were so scared of missing a God out that they said, "Well, we'll make a God over here just to give him an unknown name. We don't know who he is, but we'll worship him anyway just so he doesn't feel left out." Well, that's what they were doing in Judah. And Paul had to explain to the Athenians who God really was. Now, Malcolm is mentioned there. Malcolm is mentioned in verse 5. And it's the same word as Milcom, and it's the same word as Molech, just variations of the same god, which is a horrible Ammonite god, an Ammonite god. The worship service involved the stretched out arms of the god that were heated red hot, and then the people that were worshiping Malcolm would place their baby on the red hot arms, and the baby would be sacrificed in this way, passing through the fire to Molech, is the way it's expressed in the Bible. Well, historically, the punishment that God meted out to Judah and Israel was to send one of the surrounding nations to punish Judah or Israel for their various sins. And this time it was Babylon, who invaded Judah in the 4 separate occasions over a period of 20 years. And the pause between the invasions was a time to give them time to repent. You can imagine there might have been a 2-year pause. There was 606, 590, 606, 601, 597, and 586. There was time between invasions for them to repent, but they didn't bother. Looking at verses 7 to 13, we have the days of the sacrifice of Judah. That's how we've entitled it on your handout, I believe. And in the 3 chapters of Zephaniah, we have this word day. These verses are the days of the sacrifice of Judah, but the word day is not just one day, as we've said. It could be over a number of years. And there's periods of judgment, waves of judgment in this case when we deal with Babylon. According to verse 7, this period of judgment would be a sacrifice, and God would invite guests to the sacrifice. Now, the guests, who were the guests? Well, first of all, who was the sacrifice? The sacrifice was the nation of Judah. That was the sacrifice, and God was inviting the guests to come to this sacrifice. And the guests were the Babylonian soldiers. And they would be slaughtering many people in Judah. And then they'd be taking others into captivity. Now the prophet Daniel was taken into captivity in the year 605 BC. The prophet Ezekiel was taken into captivity in the year 597 BC. And these men, according to Jeremiah chapter 24 and verse 5, these men are described as being good figs. Good figs. Jeremiah says, like these good figs, so will I acknowledge them that are carried away captive of Judah, whom I have sent out of this place into the land of the Chaldeans for their good. You see, it was better to be taken into captivity than to be left in Jerusalem to starve, to be under siege for a number of years, to be without food, start eating your children. Cannibalism was practiced and so forth. It's better to be in captivity in Babylon to endure that sort of a problem. This was a judgment of God upon the nation of Judah. And Daniel and Ezekiel were taken out of it. In fact, Zephaniah chapter 2 and verse 3, if you read that, it says, seek ye the Lord, all ye meek of the earth, which have wrought his judgment, seek righteousness, seek meekness. Well, those prophets would have done that. It may be ye shall be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. Ye shall be hid. And they were hid. Daniel and Ezekiel and others were hidden in Babylon in the day of the Lord's anger upon Jerusalem and Judah. And that hid is a play on the name of Zephaniah, because if you look on your handout notes, Zephaniah means hidden by Yahweh. Hidden by Yahweh. And these men that I just mentioned were hidden by Yahweh. So the mercy of God was still available to the faithful in Judah. It wasn't a broad brush event where everybody was wiped out. The faithful still had mercy available to them, and many were hidden in Babylon for their good. Now in verse 8, the warning to behave goes out to the princes of Judah, and specifically to the king's children. Now this could be a warning to the children of King Josiah himself, the king's children. But our on-the-scene reporter again, Mr. Jeremiah, says nasty things were also going to be happening and did happen to the children of King Zedekiah. So whether you take it as being the king's children, namely Josiah's children or Zedekiah's children, it happened to King Zedekiah's children for sure. And the king of Babylon, says Jeremiah in Jeremiah 39, verses 6 and 7, the king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah in Riblah before his eyes. Also the king of Babylon slew all the nobles of Judah. Moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with chains to carry him to Babylon. So he wasn't hidden. He was taken into captivity in a rather ignominious way. Zephaniah 1 verse 9, we have a phrase, I will punish those who leap upon the threshold. The Revised Version says, I will punish all those who leap over the threshold. What is it all about? So what's wrong with jumping over the threshold? Instead of walking on the threshold, the space between the two doorposts, you walk over it. What's wrong with that? Let's have a look at 1 Samuel. Turn to 1 Samuel for a minute. 1 Samuel chapter 5. And you've read this a dozen times or maybe 50 times in your lifetime if you've been around that long. And 1 Samuel chapter 5 verses 1 to 5. Story of Dagon. 1 Samuel 5, 1 to 5. The Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer onto Ashdod. When the Philistines took the Ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. So they brought it into the temple of Dagon, the Ark of God. There it was. And when they of Ashdod arose early in the morrow, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the earth before the Ark of the Lord. And they took Dagon and set him in his place again. So they picked him up, set him up again. And when they arose early on the morrow morning, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the ground before the Ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off upon the threshold. Only the stump of Dagon was left to him. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor any that come into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod unto this day. So this is another idolatrous practice that was going on in Zephaniah's time, the practice of stepping over the threshold. And it appears to be an example of the Jews adopting the Philistine superstition concerning Dagon. And some people today, you know, they walk along and they don't walk on the cracks. You walk over the cracks. Why do you do that? Why do you walk over the cracks? Well, there's a little rhyme that goes like this. If you step on a crack, you will break your mother's back. That's the rhyme that you're supposed to when you're walking and you're stepping over cracks. Step on a crack, you break your mother's back. Now, is that a superstition of the 21st century or the 20th century when I was a kid? Did that superstition start with Dagon? When Dagon lost his head on the threshold of the temple, and you don't step on a crack or you don't step on the threshold because you'll break your mother's back. And maybe it did. Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 10 to 13. We have a problem described there. And if I don't move along here, I'm going to have a problem. It's money. Money. The most important activity in of our lives should not be the accumulation of wealth. That should not be what our goal is in life. Let's read verses 10 and 11. It shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord, that there shall be a noise of a cry from the fish gate, and a howling from the second, and a great crashing from the hills. Howl, ye inhabitants of the Maktesh, for all the merchant people are cut down. All they that bear silver are cut off. Now that howling would be the direct result of these Babylonian invasions that I mentioned. And those invasions always came from the north, or most of the time they came from the north part of the city of Jerusalem, and from the north of Judah. And the fish gate was located within the north wall and was called the fish gate because that's where the fishmongers came in with their fish into the city. And they sold them. And they probably came from Joppa, off from the Mediterranean, which is about 35 miles to the northwest, I believe. But that's where the fish gate was. And there was a howling from the second. Now, what is a second? It's a second development in the city of Jerusalem. Another development. It's a suburb, if you like. It's like Bear Mountain or whatever. An expansion of the city. And we're going to have a look at that on the map, because I do have a third overhead here showing the second. There it is written right on your Oxford Dictionary map. I dropped something. And there's the second right there. There's the old city of Jerusalem right there. And it's also called the city of David. It was called Jebus at one time. It was called Salem in the time of Melchizedek. But there is the old city. And there's another section, another development called the second quarter. And that's what this verse is saying, isn't it? In verse 10, and a howling from the second and a great crashing from the hills. These are all the invasions coming into Jerusalem, and the people are distressed and howling. And they'll be howling from the merchants who would see all of their wares disappearing into Babylonian hands. And the Maktesh in verse 11, what is the Maktesh? It means a hollow. You remember how the druggists used to take a mortar and a pestle and grind all the stuff and make the prescriptions? The mortar is sort of a hollow. And this is what Maktesh means. It's a hollow. And it comes from the fact that the Maktesh is the Tyropian Valley, which is between the Old City and the Second Quarter. There's a Tyropian Valley right there. And on this map, it's called the Central Valley or the Cheesemaker's Valley. The Cheesemaker's Valley, because it's a place where they sold cheese and where they made all their money. And verse 11 says, all they that bear silver are cut off. Verse 12, we have a description of the merchants who appeared godly on the outside, but inside they weren't godly. It was just good for business. And it shall come to pass at that time that I will search Jerusalem with candles and punish the men that are settled on their lees. I think when Mac read that, did you say complacent on verse 12, Mac? Oh, you didn't. It was Rod, wasn't it? Complacency? Yeah. And they say in their heart, the Lord will not do good, neither will he do evil. See, they didn't really believe in God. They were more or less atheists. They didn't think he had any real power at all. It was just a superstition, a local superstition, but it was good for business to pretend that you believed in God. But this idea that he had no power at all, was they were soon to discover otherwise when the Babylonians would come in. Because in verse 13, therefore their goods shall become booty, and their houses a desolation, and they shall also build houses but not inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards but not drink the wine thereof. And that's where we're going to end, except we're going to do a slight review of what we've done so far in Zephaniah. And we'll do the rest of the Zephaniah over the next three sessions. Zephaniah is a book. So this is what we've covered tonight, a book on the judgment of Judah upon Gentiles. It's also a message of great hope. And Zephaniah the man was part of the royal family, as we've seen, being related to King Josiah, as well as being a prophet. And both men were battling the mistakes of Manasseh, who had led Judah into idolatry, into the idolatry of Babylon. Jews were worshiping the stars, gods of surrounding nations, Tammuz, Baal, Yahweh, Chemosh, just to make sure that they covered every possible deity. We looked at the Babylonian trinity of gods. Now, this is interesting. I think it is. Nimrod, Semiramis, and Tammuz. Remember, Tammuz was considered to be the resurrected Nimrod. So we have a duality of gods, yet they're the same being, if he's the resurrected Nimrod. And Semiramis was a separate being, being the queen of heaven. And this was a problem in Judah. They were worshiping these mysteries of Babylon, and they were believed by the majority of Judah, believed in all this stuff. Now, the history of modern Christianity, the apostate Christianity around us, is similar to the Babylonian mysteries. Remember that God and Jesus Christ, by the year 324 AD, were considered to be what? A duality of gods, but the same being. Later on, the church decided that the Holy Spirit was in fact a being, so the doctrine of the Trinity was added, or came on a little bit later. So now all three are considered to be the same being. Then comes the Virgin Mary, whom the church relegated to heaven and now bears a title. What is it? the Queen of Heaven, sort of a competing Semiramis, you might say, as the Mother of God. The other problem in ancient Judah was atheism disguised as godliness for the purpose of gaining worldly wealth. Now we think of Paul's warning to Timothy, who was exhorted to beware of those having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. From such turn away. So the people in the Makdesh didn't believe God could do good or evil. It was just a local superstition. They were denying the power of God. So the exhortation to ourselves is we have to examine our priorities and decide what is important. Is it important to be at an ecclesial activity, or should we be at home watching the Olympics or some other activity? You know, soon after our own judgment has taken place, you and I hope to be in Israel to become part of a kingdom of priests. It's our hope to be allowed to help Jesus Christ administer the kingdom age activities, and not just in Israel, but all over the world. So are we focused on this goal? That's the question we have to answer. This goal of eternal salvation, where we can proclaim the glory of God in the kingdom age? Or are we just a little bit too busy in the Makdesh, in the mortar, in the marketplace, making money, which can ultimately become somebody else's booty? So those are the things we have to consider, and we'll consider the rest of Zephaniah in the weeks to come. Thank you.